Hello, I'm John Higginson, and I believe that if you dig into what you're passionate about, you tell stories that bring people with you. Communication is all about getting people to understand you. This is easier to do when you've got good stories that you truly believe in. This is why purpose-led communications is so successful. You're digging right down into why you're doing something instead of telling someone what you're doing. It's emotional and it's what you believe. And this is so powerful. In 2024, I spoke to some incredible communicators on communicating purpose. My guests are always either communications professionals or founders. The reason I include founders is because when you start an organization, you have to explain to a whole range of people, from investors to potential customers, why the thing you're starting should exist in the world. I like talking to early stage founders because they're often great at this purpose-led messaging. However, often as an organization grows larger, the leadership loses sight of its why. Their worries are about how to pay staff, cost, growth, and making a profit, and their communication suffers as a result. It's a bit like a child growing into an adult and losing their imagination. Listen to the difference here between a what explanation and a why explanation of the consultancy I run. Higginson Strategy is a communications consultancy founded by myself and my wife, Clodagh, two former national political journalists. It provides PR, public affairs, and social media services to its clients. This is what it does. Now listen to why. For any organization to grow, they need to be great at communications. Clodagh and I set up Higginson Strategy because we believe that the biggest effect we personally could have as communications professionals was by supporting the organizations we believe are solving the major challenges of our time. The bigger Higginson Strategy becomes, the bigger the positive effect on the world, because our work grows those organizations that are solving those big problems. At large organizations, for this podcast, I often speak to the communications professionals who understand the importance of the original story, why they exist. But as a consultant, I love working with founders and leaders on getting them back to the original reason they set up their organization in the first place. It's never to get rich and sail off into the sunset. There was always a problem that needed solving and a dream to do it. Supporting them to get away from the spreadsheets and the acronym-filled language of their industry is a great pleasure. It's like helping adults to see through the wide eyes of children again. However, some organizations have purpose so deeply built into their makeup that you know their founders will never lose sight of their why, no matter how large they get. One of those is vegan meat alternative company This. In January, I had the pleasure of speaking to co-founder Andy Shovel. Now, the reason I really want to speak to you is because lots of our listeners are in the communications business, and I'm in the communications business myself. And as I pointed out in that intro there, I think This has really got the comms really right. You know, I think quite often previously on plant-based stuff has been far too much around the, this is good for you, this is good for the environment. And you seem to be concentrating on, this is going to taste great. And you're concentrating on that traditional FMCG model on, you're going to buy this because it tastes great. Just tell us a bit about how you devised your communication strategy.
Sure. So at the beginning, when it was just me and Pete kind of brainstorming, it was quite clear to me that this is a very emotionally charged world that we were going to go into. It's not like dairy alternatives, right? Where people can sort of take or leave milk. They don't really care that much. But when it comes to meat, people absolutely love it. People love burgers and steaks and chicken, fried chicken, in a way that they don't love milk or cheese even, to be honest. So that comes with some very difficult dynamics when it comes to marketing, because you have got a situation where your consumer base is quite defensive from the off if they start hearing about vegan things or you know, plant-based foods, because I think they can have a tendency to instinctively put their guard up and think that you're kind of attacking them for their lifestyle choices and telling them that, you know, meat is bad. And if you eat meat, it's very grave and you're ruining the environment and all this stuff. So I was trying to think of a way at the beginning to kind of disarm people's defensiveness and get through that guard that people sometimes put up when they hear about veganism. And I decided that entertaining people and surprising people, sort of shocking people, but also just talking about good old fashioned taste appeal would be the best routes forward. So our brand has become a sort of quite silly, fun, playful brand, which kind of just seeks to entertain people and to sort of surprise people with anecdotes and stories and videos about how good our products taste and how similar to meat they are. And it's all in a sort of calculated effort to try and wade through these difficult kind of preconceptions that some people have about vegan food.
Now, one of the first campaigns Higginson Strategy worked on was for our amazing forever client, A Plastic Planet. It was February 2018, and we were introducing the world's first plastic-free aisle in an Eco Plaza supermarket in Amsterdam. It was a campaign that we achieved global coverage for and won lots of awards for, including the PRCA's International Campaign of the Year. It really made our name in the plastic-free space and environmental communications. Now, on that trip, as I often do, I looked for something to bring back for my children that you can't get in the UK, and I saw these brightly coloured Willy Wonka-ish chocolate bars. You couldn't get Tony's Chocolonely in the UK at that time. So I feel like it was one of those brands that I discovered. It's now the fourth biggest selling chocolate in the UK. Tony's is a brand that's like an onion. It has layers and layers, and every time you learn more, you like it more. In February, I spoke to Tony's Chocolonely's UK head of marketing, Nicola Matthews, about the company's why.
It sounds a bit weird, but we're not actually a chocolate company. We're not a chocolate company that makes impact. We are an impact company that makes chocolate. And that's quite a different way of thinking about a food company, I think. We only exist to achieve one clear mission, which is to end exploitation in cocoa. Now, that refers to a few things. So the 1.56 million children that are currently working illegally and the 30,000 victims of modern slavery that you have on cocoa farms in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. And that's where 60% of the world's cocoa comes from. So all the big chocolate companies will source their cocoa from there. And it also refers, exploitation also refers to the widespread deforestation that occurs in these cocoa growing communities. So it's kind of social exploitation of people and also of the planet as well. And the root cause of all of that is big chocolate companies not paying enough for their cocoa. So they, you know, people have no choice but to resort to illegal labor and also to growing cocoa in protected land to make money for their families to survive. And that is exactly what we at Tony's Chocolonely exist to change. We have developed a sourcing model that is now proven to completely, you know, dramatically reduce child labor rates from 50% down to less than 5%. And we have our whole supply chain is 100% free of deforestation. So we're proving to the big chocolate companies that it can be done. And now we are working every day to inspire all companies that buy West African cocoa to do it the way we do it and adopt our five sourcing principles. So that's us in a nutshell, cocoa shell.
And just tell us about the name, because I know that a lot of people are confused about the name. I know you've had recently some press coverage on the fact that lots of people think that you're called Chocolonely, Tony's Chocolonely, and they just read that name wrong. It's not right. It's Chocolonely. Where does that come from?
Exactly. So yeah, this has kind of been swirling on social media and TikTok and the press recently because people are genuinely shocked when they see that our name is Tony's Chocolonely. And that refers back to our origin story, which is a team of journalists in the Netherlands who were investigating this widespread child labor and modern slavery on cocoa farms and created a TV show out of it and ultimately reached out to all the big chocolate companies to see if they could work together to try and solve the problem, but realized that actually they were all profit driven and weren't really that interested in changing their supply chain if it was going to make them less profit. So the journalists decided to create their own chocolate bar and lead by example by proving that it was possible to have delicious chocolate that was a successful company and a great brand without exploiting those at the start of the supply chain. And one of the key journalists was called Tern, which is the Dutch name for Tony. And they called it Chocolonely because they really felt like it was their lonely fight against inequality in the chocolate industry. And they were out there kind of as mavericks trying to change the industry by themselves. So Chocolonely rhymes nicely, but Chocolonely has a lot more meaning to it.
Did you know that the Tony's bars come in unequal chunks to represent the inequality in the world? Do have a listen to that show to find out more. In March, I spoke to the founder of branding agency Literal Humans, Paul David. Paul cut his teeth in communications working for Barack Obama, but he told me his diverse heritage drives him. One of the great things about talking about your purpose is you're forced to dig deep to work out what drives you. I've known Paul for a couple of years, but he's never revealed the deep, intimate things he revealed on this podcast early this year.
I feel like I've always been kind of like an activist and an advocate. It's in my DNA. You know, I'm a biracial, you know, mixed race kid from the States. I grew up with queer parents. You know, I had two dads before it was cool, like in Modern Family and things like that. I have family members who've struggled with substance abuse. My mother was actually pregnant with me while she was in prison. She's struggled with heroin addiction her entire life. And, you know, all those things just, you know, I grew up with a dyslexic dad. One of my adoptive fathers is dyslexic and somehow I became an English teacher. So it's all baked in there and it all sort of like supercharged me to get into education, activism and what I'm doing now.
Is that what drives your passion into diversity?
Yeah, I think my family itself is incredibly diverse. The community that I come from and grew up outside of Philadelphia, incredibly diverse. I feel like I just benefited wildly from growing up with people from all around the globe. It was the best education I think possible. And yeah, I went to some good schools and things like that, but I think that's what fueled it. And it's allowed me to move to a place like London, you know, start an agency in an entirely new country. But it's, yeah, that passion for diversity is kind of baked into my family history. I exist because immigrants from, you know, from Italy, from Ireland, from Africa, you know, made their way, some forced, some of their own free will to America to have a better life. And in the case of the folks who did it freely and in the case of the folks who were forced, they survived. And I wake up every day and I feel blessed, you know, to be alive. And the fact that, you know, I come from such strong stock, that makes me passionate about other cultures and learning and just kind of enjoying the zest of every day.
In April, I spoke to Dr. Mark Smith, Director General of organic trade body Natru. We discussed why it's so hard for consumers to know what they're buying. How prevalent is it that companies are making claims that aren't true?
Well, if you look at, there was a report by the Commission, the EU Commission, back in 2016, and it had about, I think about 90% of claims were verified, which you could argue, therefore, it's only 10% of products on the market. And the UK was a member of the EU at that time, which would be, let's say, unsubstantiated. The thing is that when you look at 10% of the market, that's still thousands and thousands of products. When you look at the case that product claims like natural and organic are not defined, so therefore how you would actually provide a survey to identify what precisely a natural and organic claim is and when it's validated is also fairly nebulous, fairly like vague. Mm. But I think one of the most interesting ones is if you look at a recent study in 2020 that the Commission did on a Eurobarometer, there was a case that about 50% or so of product claims across all sectors, which I think about maybe 17% were cosmetics, had basically misleading claims associated with environmental 50%. Aspects of a product.
50%. Yep. And also you say 90% have been verified, but we all know from, you know, such as looking at documentaries such as Seaspiracy,
that very often these labeling bodies do very little of their own research, and largely it's just a matter of paying the organization, making a self-claim, paying them the money, and you get that mark on your product. That's the case, isn't it, really?
There's absolutely a case where, and this is part of in that same recent EU report, is that, and this is why there's a clampdown on this happening in the EU, is because it basically ends up being a proliferation of labels or iconographic claims, and there's not the capacity of the average consumer to distinguish between what is essentially a self-declaration, like a label that the manufacturer has generated and placed on pack, a kind of third-party verification system along the lines of what you've just said, where essentially it's a pay-to-play system, and you basically just pay for the right to use whomever's intellectual property. And then there's third-party systems which essentially work on more of an in-depth validation process, where you're having, a bit like ours, a combination of a documentation check and an on-site audit. And the reason why that's done is basically to validate that the characteristics that someone says that they're doing on paper, they are actually doing in practice. So, and obviously there are at least three there, which can create a problem for the consumer, yeah, because then the average consumer can't really distinguish between those three types of systems. And therefore, yeah, it can lead to distrust, basically, or sow the risk of distrust.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're doing the on-site audits, because the other two clearly aren't worth the paper they're written on. Give us an example of some of the most outlandish greenwashing claims that you've seen.
Ooh, I could say an outlandish claim that I've seen, but I guess the biggest ones that are the most blatantly obvious are ones where I've been to some trade shows, and they're major international trade shows, and there have been products which have presented themselves as organic. Now, since I'm a chemist, I could look at the ingredients, and it wasn't just a case that there wasn't a raw material that came from organic agriculture. It's simply the fact that there was not a raw material there that was natural. So I'm not really sure how they validated that claim at all. They were probably the most obvious. There are some which are more subtle and work along the case of just having like one or two ingredients in there that happen to be, let's say, natural, where the claim is anchored on the properties of one or two ingredients. That's quite a common aspect. There are problems with references to some ingredients, but the biggest one I've probably seen is where it suggested the whole product was organic and it had not even a natural ingredient in it.
In May, I spoke to Jane Stirland, MD of Walida UK. We discussed why we both love being B Corp leaders.
What really annoys me is when I see a lot of greenwashing, and you know, I know this is something very close to your own heart, whereby brands and products purport to be the best because it's a very black and white binary. We tend to want a very simple solution. What's the best product to buy? And it isn't like that at all. It's really, really complex. So the challenges we have at Walida, you know, we're 100 years old. We've been doing this for over 100 years. We were founded upon the philosophy of people, planet and profit from Rudolf Steiner, who already mentioned our founder. Our very first CEO was a woman, for example. But because we're in this bubble, I don't think we really appreciate how good we are. And we have stories to tell because we have 100 years of experience. And our big job, I think, is to live with imperfection, because everything we do is imperfect. And everything everybody does is imperfect. And if anybody tells you otherwise, then they're just greenwashing, they're lying. So that's one of the reasons I really like B Corp. So the B Corp framework, Benefit Corporation, is about the process that you go through. It's not the end goal to become a B Corp company. it's by asking yourselves those 200 plus questions about, you know, what do we do? How good are we? And every 3 years, setting the bar a little bit higher and a little bit higher.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I'm myself a massive advocate of B Corps as well. We're a B Corp, and we're coming up to that 3 year anniversary of our of first getting it, where we do have to look at it and I have to think, how are we actually better? And you have to take a bit of a step back from your day to day running of your business and go, okay, I need to relook at this. There are 120 questions that I looked at last time, and I can't just assign it to someone else. I do personally, as the founder, CEO of the company, as I'm sure you do, have to look at every one of those things and say, are we actually doing these things, and have we improved? So we work just around the corner at B Lab UK, and we're meeting with them later. And the last guest I had on our show was Dr. Mark Smith of Natrue. And I know it's another way of having a very high level of standards where you are actually audited. These aren't kind of labels where you just pay an amount of money and you put the label on the side of the pack. And I think that's particularly one of the problems that particularly the beauty industry has a problem with and has traditionally had a problem with. You know, if you think of those traditional beauty adverts, lots of them were absolute rubbish, weren't they? Do you remember the adverts from the kind of 1980s and 90s? You kind of go, this is just pseudoscience rubbish. And I think actually people have that image. So how does Walida get around that kind of image that the beauty industry and fashion industry, people already have, that they're making some of this stuff up?
I think we have to differentiate between natural organic cosmetics and certified natural organic cosmetics. So you mentioned about Natrue certify products. So our products are all certified by Natrue, which you mentioned, and that's third-party verification. B Corp is a third-party verification. If we go back, like you're talking about, I was thinking about the ads from the 80s and the 90s that this product's natural because she's washing her hair under a waterfall. Exactly, you know, we were very good. Well, was it gullible?
Timothée, I remember it well.
Yeah, we took it all on face value. And now I don't think, as a responsible company, you can say, well, just trust us because we're us. I think you need third-party verification. I think you need to work in partnership. I think there needs to be a whole coalition approach to how you do things. That might be working with your co-workers, that might be working in community, that might be having third-party verifications. And you're absolutely right, you know, purpose sits deep in the heart of the company. It's not CSR, it's not something that you give to marketing and marketing make lots of lovely stories. It has to sit deep in the heart of every single person in your business. And it comes to another C word, which is culture. How you do things around here. So if you look at the beauty industry, only 10%, but probably less than that in the UK, of beauty products are certified organic or natural. And there's no rule to say, I mean, you can have a brand name with organic in it. There are many out there that have less than 10%, probably even less than 1% organic ingredients. There's no real true legal definition.
Wow. And we also spoke about the power of TikTok and influencer marketing. Let's talk about a particular campaign, because you've said there that skin food is almost 100 years old, but yet you had this great viral campaign on probably one of the newest mediums. You know, you've got a product there that's very old, and one of the newest mediums is TikTok. You know, you've had something like 33 million people look at your skin food TikTok videos. You've got Hailey Bieber talking about it positively on TikTok. Take us behind the scenes a bit of that campaign. Was it thought through, organic? How did that all take off?
It was an experiment. We wanted to try the platform. We're great believers in experimenting. If you call it an experiment, then you're de-risking doing something. So if you think about us, you know, organic brands tend to be very middle class, tend to have a certain image, you know, certain age profile and so on. So to go on TikTok was quite radical for us. So we started with a really small campaign. and we monitored it. And we don't go in with preconceived ideas. We go in with a what if. You know, we had a couple of months ago, we had Central C saying that skin food was his favourite moisturiser. If we'd said that was a target when we started the TikTok campaign, I think even internally we wouldn't have believed it. We would have said that's just mad. So I think there's a great fear of we have a great fear of failure. It's built into business because we have this sort of, you have to succeed and you have to win. So actually having an experimental creative culture where you say, let's try TikTok, you know, let's try Love Island. Don't have preconceived ideas about what's going to work. Because for me, with skin food, every single person that has dry skin needs skin food. So don't go in with your typical marketing setup of, is this right for our target consumer? Actually, just go in and say, let's just play with this medium. Because I think TikTok has, it's incredible in terms of a communication channel. And I think particularly from, I would say, from our age, you can write some of these things off because it's not part of how you would do things or how what you've learnt about. So one of the key things is every campaign, we do an experiment. We add something new and then we see if it's worked or not.
In June, I spoke to Matt Mahmoud Ogden, who set up the Naz and Matt Foundation in 2014 to tackle homophobia in culturally conservative communities. The organisation was established following the death of Matt's fiancée, Dr. Nazim Mahmoud. Matt's ability to tap into emotion is incredible. I was fighting back tears as I recorded this podcast. Please just share the story of how the Naz and Matt Foundation came to be.
So the Naz and Matt Foundation, well, let me take you back a few years before that to tell you why the charity was started. So back in 2001, I'd recently come out to myself when I was 23 years old. I'd recently come out to myself. What I mean by coming out to myself was I finally grew stronger than the prejudice and the homophobia that existed in the community that I grew up in. And on a night out, I was just I just started to go out and find myself and explore. And on that night, that lonely night, I was sitting in an after hours nightclub, and along came a sweet, delicate voice that said in my ear, "Excuse me, may I sit here, please?" And in that moment, my whole life changed, because in that moment, Naz had arrived. And Naz sat down next to me and we started talking. And he quickly told me, I think the third question after asking my name, he asked me, he told me, he was from a very conservative religious family and he would never be able to come out to his family because he feared what might happen if and when he came out to them. So we quickly fell in love, madly, deeply in love. And within a few months, you know, we were talking about eloping to Gretna Green. We moved in soon afterwards, but living in Birmingham, which was the city we were both born in, we realised that it wasn't a particularly safe city for us to be in. You know, we could never walk down the street together because Naz feared what might happen if his family saw us walking together, if they thought we were somehow, you know, a relationship. You know, we couldn't even have the blinds open in our front room because Naz feared what might happen if his family drove past and saw us. So we went away to the bright lights of London to find freedom, to be ourselves, to live what many people just call a normal life, where you can just walk down the street without fear of something happening to you. So we, on our 10-year anniversary of that night, I got down on one knee in a packed nightclub and asked Naz to marry me. And that was the happiest day of my life, being engaged to the man that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. In 2014, we both travelled from Birmingham up to London, from London up to Birmingham to see our family. It was Eid and Naz went to visit his family. And as we were leaving that family, as he was leaving that family event, there was a confrontation. And that confrontation led Naz to break down in tears with his family. And in those tears, one of his parents came over to him and says, "Why are you crying? Why are you crying? Is it because you like men?" And Naz was 34 at the time. He's a doctor, a Harley Street GP as well. very successful in what he does, much loved in the community. But at the age of 34, he was asked a question and he thought he would never get asked directly, which is, why are you crying? Why are you crying? Is it because you're like men? And Naz didn't know how to lie. It would actually get him into trouble sometimes because he didn't know how to do anything remotely close to a lie. And in that moment, he answered honestly. And he said to the question, yes, it is because I like men. I'm in love with Matt. We're engaged and married. We've been together for 13 years. And the parents' response was to tell him to go and see a psychiatrist to be cured, because they'd heard gay people like him, or men who liked men, and they heard that they'd been cured on radio programs in the UK. And that conversation was left unfinished. And I am missing some details out just for kind of to be succinct. But 2 days after that confrontation, I got a phone call to come home, but I wasn't told why. And as I ran up the hill to the place that we'd recently moved to, when I turned the corner to the road that we lived, I saw crowds gathered, police everywhere, police tape cordoning off the scene. And as I tried to enter the property that we had moved to recently, that's when I saw a red blanket on the floor. And that's when I started to realise that something really wasn't right. And as the police put me in the back of the police car, that's when they said the words that it was desperate for them not to say. And that's when they said that Naz was no longer here. The man that I loved was no longer here. And it was Naz that was under that blanket. And then I just lost it. And the police ordered me to take me away. And in the days that followed, all I wanted to do was to follow Naz, to be with the man that I loved, to be with him. And in a moment when I was about to take my own life, instead of taking my own life, I heard Naz's voice. It was a loud, bellowing voice. And he said, and Naz's voice told me to set up a foundation or a charity or something or a group that would help other people in a similar situation to us, so that they wouldn't have to go through what we went through. And in answer to your question, that's where the Naz and Matt Foundation came from. It wasn't my idea. It was a voice that I heard of Naz that stopped me from taking my own life. And I started to realise, if this has saved my life, why can't we use it to help others?
I also spoke to Celia Richardson, Director of Communications and Marketing at the National Trust. The National Trust is a national institution which aims to protect heritage and natural landscapes for future generations to enjoy. But as such, it often comes under attack from parts of the media if it tries to do anything differently. We create teasers to pull people into the podcast through Higgins & Strachey's social media feeds. The clip you're about to listen to got more than 60,000 plays and 3,000 likes when we shared it on our TikTok feed. How were you accused of making us gone woke?
Well, it was a bank holiday weekend, and the National Trust is where a lot of England and Wales go on a weekend. So we're always of interest on a bank holiday weekend. Our press office expects some sort of nonsense on the Thursday or Friday. So we had a call from the Daily Mail saying they'd found that we were secretly using vegetable-based spread in our scones. Now, you and I think are old enough to remember a thing called margarine. The National Trust hasn't used butter in its tea room scones. We make millions every we serve 2 or 3 million a year. I can't remember which. So we've always used margarine or a vegetable based spread. That's never been an issue. But for some reason, the Daily Mail wanted to say that we'd secretly changed our recipe in order to pander to vegans or minorities generally. I mean, you know, people who don't have dairy, yeah. I think. And, you know, what the funny thing, well, not the funny thing, the serious thing is it would be illegal for us to, you know, keep our recipes a secret, highly illegal. And also the very funny thing for me was just that, you know, it turned out the Daily Mail had published our scone recipe 4 or 5 years before, the exact one they were railing against, saying it was scrumptious. So, you know, it was just one of those silly stories. But then it became a thing about us being woke and disrespecting heritage. GB News did a section on it. You know, the story ran and ran for a few days. But, yeah, it was called Secret Virtue Signalling. I don't know how you can signal virtue secretly. But, yeah, it was one of those stories. And it's often that the question is usually, are you serving this part of the nation and not that part of the nation? So this idea that we've changed something in order to serve a different part of the nation, here being vegans, vegans or people who don't eat dairy for whatever reason, it had the hallmarks of a good old story. And, you know, the scone's pretty iconic. So why wouldn't you choose the scone if you wanted to have a culture war story? Yeah.
In July, I spoke to former Labour Director of Strategy, Carl Schoben, about how political communications is going back to grassroots after years of professionalisation. Polished politicians are out and soapboxes and outdoor media are in. Jeremy Corbyn, Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson all have one thing in common. They all appear unpolished and real to the electorate. Their success is in part a reaction to people getting fed up with the polished politicians of the 1990s and noughties, argues Carl.
I think what you're seeing in this general election is some return to some more traditional communications methods. So you're seeing more outdoor advertising. You're seeing more election debates than you would normally see. It's normally very limited, but you're on telly virtually every other night. You're seeing a bit of a return to more traditional campaigning, and I think that's really good. I think, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but one of the potential downsides of the massive professionalization of politics and communications is too much control over the central message, too many politicians appearing on television and not saying much, or not saying, you know, trying to avoid saying anything controversial. And then I think that contributed to a degree of apathy and cynicism that was obviously already there. So I think, you know, creeping back, and you can sort of see some of this, by no means this isn't the only cause, but the relative success of politicians that are less PR professional. You could say Boris Johnson, you could say Nigel Farage, you could say Jeremy Corbyn. They're all politicians which have had peaks and troughs in the last few years. But I wonder if you wouldn't have seen those politicians succeeding 15 years ago in a way that they have come about and enjoyed at least some short-term success, because they represent more of a return to a more traditional grassroots style of politics and communications. And I can see that beginning to see some of that in the general election now, a bit of a return to some more old-fashioned PR.
Yeah. Well, we saw it in Clapton, didn't we, with Nigel Farage just grabbing hold of the speaker passed to him by his head of communications, Gawain Towler, who had it on top of his head, and, you know, just the old-fashioned get on top of a soapbox type style. You spoke about Jeremy Corbyn there. You were his head of strategy for 2 years. And, you know, if we look back at his time, he had huge communications wins. I'm thinking back to kind of a whole crowd of people at Glastonbury. It's coming up to Glastonbury soon. Whole crowd of people at Glastonbury shouting out his name at Glastonbury. You never had that about any other politician.
Yeah.
But then it didn't convert at the ballot box. Yeah. Just tell me about the biggest wins and failures of that, because it's such a great example.
I mean, he had a relative win at the ballot box in 2017, in the 2017 election, you know, where he did far exceeded expectations. And I think that was about saying things that he believed in, and that came across. And many of those things were things that had been excluded from a sort of public debate. So, you know, things like public ownership is very popular, and, you know, people want to see the rich tax, you know. So what he was doing was, I think, at a certain point in time, reflecting the public's anger and cynicism towards politics and just what they perceived as unfairness in society. So I think that communications is part of the apathy that people feel. So the tight control and professionalization of political communications means that for a long period of time, you had politicians that were trained not to say things that could be controversial. okay, which meant that these issues of inequality, unfairness and so forth didn't get mentioned very much, or they were done in quite a controlled way. So I think the initial success of Jeremy Corbyn reflected people's, oh, here's a guy who's just telling it like it is, okay? And if you ever worked with Jeremy, or you know Jeremy, Jeremy has no red light in his head when he's doing a political interview. He's not thinking, I shouldn't say that because that will get me into trouble. He is saying exactly what he thinks. Now, that is an incredibly dangerous thing for a political leader to do, but it also at various points worked for him and infused a lot of people. Where I think that sort of strategy started to fail was politics is incredibly complicated and you can't rely on being totally open and honest and saying what you think, because in politics you have to form a coalition, a workable coalition that is big and broad enough to get elected. And I think we tried incredibly hard with Jeremy and, you know, with the Labour Party at that era, in that period, but we just could not, under that leadership, reconcile a big enough coalition to get elected. I think it nearly succeeded in 2017, but the Brexit issue, combined with Jeremy's slight unwillingness to do what it takes to form that strategic alliance, just could not sustain itself with an issue as complicated as Brexit.
John Lewis is the leading light of employee-owned businesses. So I was pleased to speak to John Lewis Partnerships Senior Communications Manager, Michelle Stageman. Tell us about a big communications win that you've had over the years.
I always think that one of the best successes or the biggest wins comes from feeling like you've literally got no option and you're not sure where to go with a story or a campaign or a project that you've been given or you've worked on. And one of my favourite things I've worked on, when I was at M&S, we were challenged relatively late on as a comms team to activate one of the Christmas campaigns. I think I mentioned it earlier, Follow the Fairies, which was Magic and Sparkle. So it was our M&S Christmas ad, which again, at that point, obviously I've crossed into the other realm now, so I'm at JL. So we were always looking at how we could get to where JL were. And we had Magic and Sparkle, our Christmas fairies, and there was at the sort of 11th hour, a challenge that came from quite senior up to say, how do we activate this? How can we create an execution that's interesting, different, bold? How do we snatch those headlines, you know, without the just copying the JL formula? That wasn't the exact brief. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, how do we get some more buzz for our ad? And we worked with a number of agencies, both comms agencies and our marketing agencies, our ad agency, to come up with these activation ideas. And we came up with this teaser campaign called, it was basically hashtag Follow the Fairies. This must have been about 10 years ago now. And we basically went into this kind of huge tease phase where we wanted to create buzz and excitement and almost this mystery around different locations of the UK. So we overnight made it snow in a school in Cornwall, which was so close to the sea that it had never snowed in that community. So we literally made it snow using some giant snow machine. I don't know. The agency sorted that out. And then we sort of had all the pictures done, sold in the picture story. None of it was brand specific. None of it mentioned M&S. It was just hashtag follow the fairies. And no, everyone was asking, who are these fairies? Like, what are they doing? So that was the first thing. And it created a bit of, you know, mystery. Like, where's this come from? The kids absolutely loved it. We created some film. We were up all night editing and creating this film that went out. And we were doing social listening, making sure it went out all over. And then we did some mystery kind of graffiti sketches, art on the Thames path that, again, were sort of talking, like hinting at what was coming. And there was loads of things we did. We did lots of sort of surprise and delight and gifting, but it was all, you know, follow the fairies. Can you nominate someone to receive someone who's deserving, a nurse or someone who's worked really long hours and are really up against it, got young kids, that kind of person, and giving these lovely parcels and these gifts to flowers, you know, hampers, that kind of thing. And this went on for a couple of weeks, gathering all this content. And this was before content was king, I think, really. It was almost on when it was tipping. So we had all this amazing content. And then what we did was, with the ad launch and the unveiling, which was during, I think, the X Factor, which is what we used to do back then. It was not social first. We unveiled the Follow the Fairies, or actually the M&S Fairies Magic and Sparkle. And I remember sitting there, we're all in a war room at the agency with the, you know, social agency, the media agency, the comms agency, the ad agency, all sitting there watching the ads like play out. And then we were reacting in real time on Twitter, which, sorry, I should have said this was a Twitter campaign, because I think this was before Instagram even had stories, or I don't even know if it existed, but it was very much a Twitter first campaign. And it was all around the hashtags and building momentum of this hashtag and what, you know, getting it trending and, you know, unveiling that it was actually M&S that was attached to this activity that had been going on in secret for the last few weeks. And then it was carrying it on through the Christmas sort of sustain phase. So in shops, you'd be able to surprise and delight. You'd be given the power as an employee to, you know, give someone their shopping for free, or give them a free bottle of wine or some flowers, or people that you recognise, community spirit. People could nominate using the hashtag for people that were deserving of these gifts. We were going out giving people Christmas dinners and so many different things, so many different strands of it. And at the end of it, we were all absolutely on our backs, exhausted. But it was the most fast-paced, reactive. It wasn't on the plan. It was literally dreamt up, and we came up with it within about a week, and getting it all signed off, getting the budget, getting everything agreed, and then down in Cornwall making it snow, you know, by Thursday lunchtime. It was one of those campaigns that when it was all done and dusted, I think the fairies signed off on Christmas Eve, and obviously off they went for until whenever they came back next. But it was absolutely brilliant because it was so collaborative, and it was probably one of the first big cross-agency campaigns that I've worked on as well, which that's how we work now. But back then it was very, you know, comms do this, advertising do this, marketing do this, and it was quite separate, where it was really integrated, and it was so much fun, if not absolutely exhausting. It's a good job I didn't have kids then, let's just say that.
The Samaritans is the biggest charity in the UK and Ireland, concentrating on suicide prevention. Suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50 in the UK, with three times as many men dying from suicide as women. Just opening up a conversation with a stranger can be the difference between life and death. Here's Sonia Trivedi, the Samaritans Director of External Communications.
We are the leading suicide prevention charity across the UK and Ireland. And, you know, we are best known for our listening service. So we are there on the phone. We actually have a correspondence branch. People can actually write to us and get responses. And we have over 201 branches, 23,000 incredible volunteers. And the key thing about our service is it's free, it's confidential, and it's non-judgmental. And we take a call for help every 10 seconds. So within that, my role is to look after our fundraising department. So we have to raise over £20,000 a year to keep our service running and to ensure that it does remain free, because we want anyone who's faced an emotional crisis to be able to reach out to us. Within that team, I am also responsible for our work with the Rail Network. So Network Rail, that is a multifaceted partnership. So we have trained over 30,000 people across the rail environment to spot the signs of people struggling to cope and in suicide prevention. We work at a local level, so with train operating companies. And a big part of our work with them is our awareness raising campaigns. So the one that people are probably most familiar with, because it's been running for a number of years now, is Small Talk Saves Lives. So that is about encouraging the general public to have the confidence, if they spot someone and they, you know, something doesn't look quite right, if it's right and it's safe to do so, you know, maybe just approach them and, you know, make a bit of small talk, you know, oh, do you know where I can get a coffee around here, something like that. So that it could potentially break their feelings. You know, they might be in quite a dark place, they might be having suicidal feelings, to break their thoughts. So that's a really important campaign for us.
In September, I spoke to Emma Kay, who founded the app WalkSafe to help people, particularly women, plan the safest way home to avoid crime after she was sexually harassed on a journey home. You've had more than 570,000 downloads of WalkSafe. What have you found the most effective form of communications for you?
So I think we're on track for nearly a million now, which is awesome. But I suppose my biggest metric is always how many people are active within the app. But yes, it's been a journey. And I would say that our probably always our most effective form of communication is news and social media. I would say communicating our purpose and my experiences and being able to share why it's been created, the need for it, has always been a really important piece for WalkSafe. And after the high profile case that we mentioned, I actually did a huge media round, and that was where we were on GB News, Sky News, BBC. I did a lot of radio. I would say I really enjoy talking through the sort of complex problems that I think we see in society and how I feel that our solution can, it isn't a full solution by any means, but it definitely is part of a safety toolkit for many people. And I would say, you know, I think my skill set lends itself to spoken word. And I think that interviews and podcasts like we're doing now are really my skill set. And I think there's always so much happening in the news, and I think it's always quite depressing. I know it's within the Labour manifesto, it's something that the Met are always talking about. Violence against women and girls is always a hot subject, and it's always on people's agendas. So I think that we can really communicate why it is relevant to so many people, whether that's, you know, your loved ones or even within your business. And I think the news gives us that credibility as a startup. I think it gives us that platform to drive new users and hopefully to really convey the authenticity piece, which is, I am that person, I do know how it feels. And, you know, we're a female founded startup, and I think that's really vital, because I look at the sort of personal safety app landscape, there's a lot of men in this sphere, and I think it's really vital that I can convey my lived experience, because then people can relate to it.
In October, I spoke to co-founder of She Changes Climate, Antoinette Vermillier, where we talked about the power of using simple messages to change the world. Now, we met a few years ago, Antoinette, and I remember a mutual friend coming to me and saying, there's this new group called She Changes Climate, and I'm on the WhatsApp group of it, and they've got a huge, huge number of really high level, interesting people on that. And I think you should get involved, John, in what they're doing. And this was at COP26. I think it's 3 years ago now. Yeah, we're on COP29 now, which was in Glasgow. So there was even more interest in the UK because it was a COP in UK. COP, for those that don't know, is the UN Conference of the Parties, and it's where every year all the countries come together to talk about the environment and what we can do as nations. So that's why that's important. And I remember at that one, the president was Alok Sharma, and there was this story that there wasn't nearly enough women in the leadership position. I don't think there were any women on there. And you and Bianca Pitt, who is the other co-founder of She Changes Climate, you said, look, we want to do something about this. It's wrong that there aren't more women in leadership positions. And we want to do a letter. And at Higginson Strategy, we do lots of these public letters. So we said, absolutely, we're going to help out with this and bring that support. And it was great fun doing that. We got lots of media attention. And then you went off and did other things. And just tell us about, what have you done since? What have you learned from growing She Changes Climate to where it was 3 years ago, where you, I think you were just really starting out to what you're doing today?
Actually, I think it's 4 years ago.
Oh, 4 years.
Yes, it was 4 years ago. So just to give some background, my work and intention has always been to move forward on marine issues. And One day, an article appeared in The Guardian showing that actually it was Boris Johnson who had selected 12 people to his team, high-level team for COP26, that were all men. And it was one of those slap your forehead in the, you know, with your palm and go, what's going on? I thought this had been resolved. So we all went, ugh, you know, as one does. You hear something that annoys you and you go away. And that night I was sleeping, and I don't sleep a lot because of my ADD. So I was like, hang on a second. I don't really care what happens at COP, but what happens at COP affects me. So we have all of us who are involved in the environment, we're going to have to work on this. And that was the seed for which She Changes Climate was born. The good news is at the end of She Changes Climate, and what was interesting about this, and thanks to your help in adding a huge public focus on it, what we didn't realize, and we worked into this, Bianca and I walked into this almost somewhat blindly. We said, let's get an open letter. Let's get high-level signatories, women, to sign it. But at the same time, we're not going to publish it. We're going to talk to the government. We're going to say, you need to add more people to the team. What I didn't realize is that we were against, and I live abroad, so I don't really know much about the British civil service, but this was a huge thing. And in fact, there were ambassadors from Peru I was talking to who said, oh, we've heard about your letter. And I was like, what? Because the threat of that letter being published was enough to galvanize and create concern at behind the scenes. So we learned a valuable lesson there that sometimes you need a little sting or a trigger that might or might not be launched to generate action. Instead of inertia, we need actual energy.
London's Natural History Museum is the fourth most visited museum in the world, but it's not just a museum. In November, the Natural History Museum's Director of Communications, Dan Phelan, told me how he refers back to the founding text of 150 years ago to create its modern communication strategy.
We're the fourth most visited museum in the world. We're kind of neck and neck with the British Museum when it comes to the most popular indoor visitor attraction in the UK. But actually, we were set up not just as a museum, but as a centre for scientific research. So our founder, Richard Owen, nearly 150 years ago, had a vision for a cathedral to nature. And there were two parts of that, the museum, so showing the wonders of nature, and also a hub for scientific research. 150 years later, we've got a collection of 80 million objects from the natural world, spanning billions of years. And our scientists, and in fact scientists all over the world, use the data that that collection contains to help them understand the past, the present, and try and understand what the future might be of the natural world. So when it comes to the comms strategy, actually the comms and PR team here spend a lot of time placing stories about the scientific research that our scientists do. That's research into biodiversity loss, habitat change, climate change, emergent diseases, all the big kind of existential questions that are facing humans at the moment. So they do a great job doing that, as well as, of course, publicising our amazing exhibitions. And then since I've been here, we've gone through a big piece of brand work. So we've rebranded the museum, marketing team have led that. We've changed our brand, and the new brand we think really helps people understand we're not just a visitor attraction, but we're also a scientific research centre. And then, of course, working across digital as I do, so the website and the our social media channels really helps. I can really support colleagues to get a consistent message about who we are through all of our channels, whether they're earned, owned, or bought media.
Earlier in December, I spoke to Camille Hussein, Director of Communications and Partnerships at RAND Europe. Before this, he worked at Tortoise Media and was also Deputy Director of External Relations at Chatham House. I couldn't help asking him about the Chatham House role. You spent 10 years at Chatham House.
I did.
And I can't think of a better
bit of PR in the whole world than having everyone sat around any table where they want to make sure that people speak freely around the table, and saying, as they often do, this is under Chatham House rules. And they always say rules. Tell us about, one, your work there, and how the hell did they get that great bit of branding so that suddenly everyone knows about Chatham House through that?
Well, on the rule, as I try not to be too pedantic about reminding people, there is only one rule, the Chatham House rule, and people who work at Chatham House often correct people on social media when we feel a bit peeved. But the rule itself,
they should be saying this is Chatham House rule, not plural.
Yeah, right. there's only one rule, and if you ever visit the building, it's inscribed in one of the walls outside the library. But ultimately, the Chatham House rule serves as a function, as you say, to foster open dialogue and debate. What it isn't is a off-the-record rule or a Vegas rule. It's a non-attribution rule. The idea is that, John, you and I can have a conversation under the Chatham House rule. You can impart ideas and information. I can make use of that. What I can't do is attribute that information back to you. And right. That applies whether it's 4 people in the meeting, 10 people in the meeting, however many people in the meeting. And it's the rule that fundamentally succeeds because of the spirit of its application. People understand it's quite a subtle distinction, which is you can use this information. No one is telling you that this information stays in this room, but you have to be mindful and responsible in terms of your sourcing, not to attribute it to any one individual who may not wish for that information to be traced back, the provenance of it to be traced back to them. And it's worked because it's supported over the years track 2 dialogues where during, moments of diplomatic crises, Chatham House has played quite an important role in the background, facilitating discussions between protagonists that have led to breakthroughs. So, for example, if those of us who studied the Cold War, the original Cold War, and détente in the late 70s or early 70s maybe, there were discussions between the Soviets and Europe, the sort of allied partners, that required track 2 diplomacy, and Chatham House was one of the institutions that was active in organizing those conversations. Partly maybe because it was always seen as an organization that is quite good at getting people to talk. Who came up with this rule? It's probably one of the original diplomats who, after the Paris Peace Conference, at the conclusion of the First World War, came back and founded Chatham House, or the British Institute of International Affairs, as it was known then. And their American counterparts went back to the US and founded the Council on Foreign Relations. They probably thought a neat way to have open dialogue is to formalize it in a rule, in a set of language.
Right. So
we can say.
So it's been around for 100. It's been around for about 100 years. That's in the 1920s, is it?
Yeah. Since the origination of the Institute, and it's, I think, had 3 or 4 maybe revisions to the text, subtle revisions. Oh, okay. But the spirit of the rule has remained unchanged. Because I think
A lot of people are confused about that rule. I know that lots of time people think that as soon as someone says it's Chatham House rules, that means that the discussion doesn't go beyond the room. So thank you for clarifying from Chatham House itself that anything said, it's just a non-attribution rule.
Absolutely.
And those things can, just as long as you're not saying who said it, it can go beyond the walls. Finally, just before Christmas, I spoke to Beth Knight, Head of Social Sustainability at Lloyds Banking Group. Set up in 1775, Lloyds is one of Britain's biggest financial institutions with more than 30 million customers. Beth has a background with some of the biggest consultancies, EY and Accenture, as well as working for the world's biggest online retailer, Amazon. I was interested to learn how her experience at these highly success-driven organisations helped her to reach underserved communities at Lloyds.
I mean, I really
now as a business owner of a consultancy, really respect the large management consultancies. Whereas when I was a journalist, I thought, like a lot of people, that, you know, consultants come in, and I couldn't really work out why they were paid so much money and why people would do it. And the one thing I've really learned from the way that they work is just that holding feet to the fire. And I think there's a huge amount you can learn from the ability to be very goal orientated and set very clear KPIs. And it's something I'll try and do within Higginson Strategy, the consultancy I run. I mean, I have a bit like a kind of sales team. We've got KPIs written up on the wall for every single client. And those are from the contracts, because quite often if you don't do that, meetings can run on and people can say, oh yes, we're doing a strategy and it's doing this, that and the other. And that's certainly one bit that I think people from consultancies have an advantage there from people that haven't had that consultancy background. Do you agree with that?
I think that it helps. It's like a muscle you have to train. I wouldn't say that those that work in-house don't have it, but I think it's a muscle you use often when you're working in consulting. So you're going to be exceptional at problem solving, because you're going to be brought in because there's a specific challenge or there's something really noodly or multipolar and complex that they need somebody that thinks three-dimensionally to get their heads around, and that has a lot of external perspective. And quite often that is consultants. And I think the best consultants that I've seen and worked with have been those that are problem solvers, that are goal-orientated. I think having that laser focus, be it through a KPI stuck on your wall or really, really holding yourself to a contract, is how you get a really good kind of impact from your work. I saw this as well working in-house at Amazon. So Amazonians are very focused on working backwards from goals, extremely goal-orientated, at stretching above and beyond just a goal, I would say as well. So yes, that might be the objective or the equivalence of a KPI in the contract, but what is it that the customer needs? How can you be customer obsessed? How can you work backward from that need? And I've learned a huge amount from both those work environments, and then applying those to, you know, if your customer is the most underserved or a underserved person within an economic or a social context, how do you work backwards from that? And their journeys are often the most complex and the most broken, because they're not the people that the system that we're operating within it was designed for. And so for me, in being purpose-led and choosing to think about social sustainability through that lens and prioritise my work there, that's enabled me to truly advocate for customers that can benefit from those skills.
That's all the space we have time for in this highlights reel from 2024. However, there are other fantastic guests that I've not had space to have on this podcast. And if you like the sound of any of those conversations, please do listen to the full interview. I have been recording Communicating Purpose for the last 3 years, and I believe 2024 was the best yet. A huge thank you to producers Catherine Kitchen and Ted Thissinger. We're now booking in guests for 2025. If you have a suggestion for who I should get on the show, or if you'd just like to discuss how you can improve your own purpose-led communications, please write to me directly at john@higginsonstrategy.com. Have a happy new year.